Today, your questions answered. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, World's Latest Post, covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. I wanted today to give some time to your questions. These are the questions that I've accumulated over the last 3 or 4 weeks, and despite running 2 live streams each month, I still haven't been able to get through them. In fact, I had more than 600 questions in all sorts of categories. And what I tried to do was to deal with the main themes as best I could, but there were still many more than I could cover. So today I'm going to spend some time going into some more detail and hopefully answering those specific questions. Now, I need to just caveat this with a couple of things. Firstly, this is not financial advice. This is just general commentary based on my research and analysis. If you want to get detailed financial advice about your own personal circumstances, you must go to a financial advisor. I'm not fulfilling that role at all. And therefore, you should take my advice with a pinch of salt. It's just my own opinion. It's just my own reading. But nevertheless, perhaps I can give you some perspectives or at least point you to some questions that you should be considering with regards to these particular questions that actually are coming up quite frequently now. And of course, because of what's happened with regards to the virus and the economic slowdown, many more people are scratching their heads about what to do with their financial affairs. Should they buy property? Should they change their superannuation? Should they save more? Should they spend more? Should they borrow more? I mean, all of those questions are up in the air at the moment, especially as more households are clearly under financial pressure. So what I'm going to do is go to each question and hopefully provide a little bit of insight. And it's worth saying, of course, that these questions are unedited as far as I can, but nevertheless, the fact of the matter is these represent quite clearly a lot of the questions that are on people's minds. So the first one comes from Ronnie. And Ronnie said, I'm keen to know what you think about the following. I've lost about 7% of my super so far. Would I be better off moving the super investments to cash for the time being? With regards to the likely property price fall, is the same story true for all states and territories, or is this more pertinent in the eastern states? Are certain areas and suburbs likely to be more affected? Is it possible that properties in established, tightly held areas are less likely to experience a dramatic decline? And thirdly, with regard to having cash in the bank, is it better to have cash in Australia rather than overseas institutions? Thanks very much for your wonderful resources. Well, there's just 3 small questions there, Ronnie. Okay, let's start with the superannuation one first. The fact of the matter is that most people's superannuation will be less now than it was. And depending on the mix of investments that you had, and that's a combination of bonds and shares and other investment class assets, you will have probably taken something of a hit. Now, the problem is if you then move your superannuation from one to another or from one type to another, in a way what you're doing is locking in that loss. So the first thing you need to consider is whether you think, in fact, the markets are going to continue to fall or whether you think the markets are, in fact, bottoming and now are going to move up. Because if they're going to move up, then the best thing to do is to ride the escalator down and hopefully ride the stairs up and see the value of those investments recover. But my own perspective would be, I think it's quite unlikely that we're going to see the stock markets bouncing back anytime soon. And it is quite probable that we're going to see more falls ahead, not necessarily in the next couple of months, but perhaps next 6 months to 12 months. And that's driven by a couple of things. Firstly, it's driven by the fact that we still don't know how this virus thing is going to play out. The chances are that there won't be a V-shaped recovery. The chances are it will take a long time to bring the economy back towards a more neutral position and then hopefully a growth position. And during that time, dividends paid by many companies will continue to deteriorate rather than improve. So I think stock market performance is going to remain in the doldrums for some time. Now, what about returns on cash? Well, the point about cash is that you may not get very large returns, but hopefully you won't get more capital losses. And that, of course, is the reason why as you move towards retirement, you will generally have a greater proportion of your superannuation in cash so that you are insulated from downside falls. So I think the question then is, where are you in your life cycle of superannuation? You know, if you're younger, you can probably ride the falls and hopefully we'll get the upside when the markets recover in 3 to 5 years' time. If you are later in your saving cycle, then you probably want to be more secure against further downside risk. And that means that actually moving to cash, even if you lose a little bit in the process, is probably worth considering. And the final point to make is that if you are in a super fund and you stay in that super fund and other people whip their cash out of the fund, then by definition, your losses are going to be greater. And I think 7% is not bad. There are many super funds that have done a lot worse in the last couple of months. So that's the last thing to say on that. Now, with regard to the property price falls, yes, it does vary very much by type of property and location. Clearly, the East Coast is most overvalued, whereas the West Coast is less so. And I've had the view for some time that it will be predominantly houses on the East Coast that will hold their value a little better than units. But units down the East Coast, particularly the high-rise areas, is where the first falls will come from. We're already seeing that prices are down between 6 and 10%. And also houses on the modern estates on the urban fringe of our major centres. And again, we're seeing prices already falling there as more property prices are coming on the market, as more property is coming on the market. So we're in the situation at the moment where some people are taking their properties off the market because they don't necessarily think they're going to get value if they sell now. But there are others being forced to sell. And that's part of the reason why we think prices will slide. So I think you have to look granular. I think you have to differentiate between the units and apartments and houses. And I actually think that the inner ring houses in the perhaps more expensive areas around our major centres will actually do reasonably well. They'll probably drop between 5 and 20%. Whereas those outer rim houses and apartments, on my modelling, could be 20 to 30% down, quite easily even more. On the West Coast, where they're already 20% down from their peaks, they've still got more downside risk there too, but probably not quite as much. And then the third question you asked was about cash in the banks. Is it better to have cash in Australian rather than overseas institutions? Now, the thing to understand is that there is the government deposit guarantee scheme, and that guarantees up to $250,000 per brand, per relationship, for Australian banks and those overseas organisations with Australian licences in Australia. Now, to understand which banks are actually caught within the scheme, you need to go to the APRA website, and there they list out all of the individual banks that are actually covered. Now, it's true to say that most of the operations of overseas banks in Australia, because they have an Australian banking licence, are required to conform to the Australian banking regulations. And as a result of that, the fact is that most of those organisations are covered, but not all. So you need to go into detail, you need to look at the APRA site. Now, the reason the 250k is important is simply because the chances are that if a bank were to fall over, then it could be that you lose your deposit. Remember, a deposit is essentially an unsecured loan to a bank. So it's not really held in trust for you. It is an unsecured loan. And that means that in the future, there is a risk that if a bank falls over, deposits could be removed. As a result of that, the government scheme is there to protect those deposits up to the $250,000. The only catch is that scheme has to be activated by the government. So in fact, it's a theoretical scheme at the moment until it's activated by the government. And the problem that I see is if you have lots of banks all falling over at the same time, then the scheme might not be robust enough to cover everybody. It's really designed for a one-off failure. And there's also another limit as to how much is actually paid out to one entity. So it isn't very straightforward, unfortunately, but that's my own view. And So to answer your specific question, most Australian banks will be under the scheme. Some international banks with a banking license in Australia will be under the scheme, but you need to go check with APRA. Now, Luke asked me this question. I've got a worrying question in my mind. Now, Luke's got an interesting question. I've got a worrying question on my mind. I recently sold my property, which has given me a good problem to be in. I've got $280,000 sitting in one bank account. And considering the global situation in hand, what would be the safest measure to protect yourself? Would it be a term deposit? Would a term deposit be the smartest option in the current climate? Well, it's always difficult to know, isn't it? Because if you're trying to protect yourself, there are two things. One is, are you trying to protect yourself from cash loss? So you want to make sure that the money's there. Or are you trying to get some return on the funds? Now, of course, term deposits are available. And in fact, the rates on term deposits have gone up a little bit relative to where they were a couple of months ago. And that's partly because banks are now much more desperate to get term deposits to help drive their balance sheets. But the returns are not great, but at least there are some returns. With regards to the 280K, the limit, as I mentioned just now, is 250K under the government guarantee. So in theory, if a bank fell over, you would be protected out of that limit. So you may want to think about separating it into two different lots with different institutions under different brands. So, for example, if you went to St. George and Westpac, that's under the same brand umbrella, so that would only be one 250K security block. So you need to actually go with two organisations. I think if you did that, my own view, for what it's worth, is, and I've done this myself, I went to cash some time back, and I'm sitting in term deposits in a number of different organisations. Some are overseas organisations here in Australia with Australian banking licences, according to the APRA website, and some local organisations. And that gives me a sense of security that at least the cash is going to be there, firstly. And secondly, I'm getting a small return, not massive, but a small return on the cash. And in the current environment, I think that's worth quite something. Now, Craig asked, as the residential property market begins to slow, which sector do you believe will feel the stress first, top or lower? And secondly, over the last 6-7 years, I've periodically taken note of the total number of listings on realestate.com for my region, the Gold Coast. I've seen them as high as 11,000, but on average between 9,000 and 10,000 today. There are 7,750, the lowest I've seen. Why do you think this is the case? And do you think this trend will continue while we have the COVID-19 situation? Craig, it's a very good question. Firstly, the way this tends to work out generally is the top end goes first. And in fact, we saw quite significantly strong price movements, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne, over the last 6 months or so. And that was because whilst there was a small number of transactions, they were very big price moves. And a lot of those were really very expensive properties, so 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 million. They will be the ones probably to go first. But what tends to happen is it tends to cascade down the market. And this time we have something else, which is we've got more households under pressure and more households signalling they may need to sell. And therefore, I do expect to see price falls across the other types of property too. And I said just now, including units, I think units will be where the action will also be. And we're already seeing quite a lot of people with investment properties, often ex-Airbnb properties, where effectively they decided to move on and to try and sell to release what capital there is. Now, the way this often works is that it's not uniform in different in every location. And in the Gold Coast, I had a look, you're right, the listings are quite a long way down relative to where they used to be. And that is, I think, because there at the moment, people are less likely to sell because they know if they do sell, they're going to lose quite a lot of capital. There will, I think, in a few months' time, and that's particularly post the government intervention, if they start taking that away again, we're going to see more households getting into difficulty. And therefore, I would expect to see the supply of property increasing coming onto the market. We're also noting, by the way, an increase in the number of rental properties listed in that area. So what we're seeing at the moment is an interesting pincer movement between rentals and unoccupied property. Less unoccupied property unlisted, but more rental property listed. And a lot of that rental property is actually being used by investors. So if those investors are unable to find a tenant, they will be forced to sell later. So I would suggest to you that if you wait a bit, you will see volumes rising. And as volumes rise, of course, on a supply and demand element, you would expect to see prices fall further. And indeed, on the Gold Coast, my expectation is that prices for houses will fall between 10 and 15% over the next couple of years. But for units, they could be significantly worse affected by falls. Now, Jared asked, and he said, this could be of interest to you and the broad audience. I would love to hear your opinion on the idea that the natural state of a modern economy is deflationary because of the impact of technology and efficiency. And he cites Jeff Booth there. And yeah, this is all about this wonderful question about how is the future going to play out, right? Because essentially, there are two potential futures. The first future is actually an inflationary future driven by all of the money printing that the central banks around the world are doing, including, to an extent, the RBA here, but actually mostly the Bank of Japan, the ECB, and of course, the Fed. Now, what that is doing is effectively putting more money into the system against the same assets in the system. And that gives you a sense of why inflation might be an outcome. And that would mean that essentially you would have to probably see interest rates rising a bit later, and you'd have to see the costs of everything rising dramatically, other than probably incomes that would stay pretty static. Now, many people, I have to say, many economists and many people who have an interest in selling gold are pushing the inflation story very hard. Not least because in an inflationary environment, gold tends to hold its value better and it could be a hedge against future inflation. So every time you hear somebody talking about inflation, ask yourself whether they actually have an interest in gold, because perhaps that could be influencing their position. The other side of the equation is deflationary, and that basically is when things go the other way. And despite all the money printing, despite all the asset purchases, the real momentum in the economy decreases. Incomes go lower, property prices and other stock market prices go lower, and we get into a deflationary spiral. In that situation, interest rates will stay lower for longer, and the economic momentum in the economy will also be very weak. And the classic example is Japan. So the Bank of Japan has been buying everything. They've bought stocks, shares, they've bought mortgage-backed securities, all sorts of things. And in fact, they have a high proportion of ownership now of the whole Japanese economy because of it. And yet, there is still the deflationary cycle. And there's a couple of reasons. The first is a demographic cycle, because essentially we've got lots of older people in Japan. And that means that essentially you've got a smaller productive economy and you've got more people living off the rest. But the second, I think you've pointed to, is the technological innovation that's happening now. In fact, the number of jobs that are being created are probably lower than they used to be. The types of job are different, more gig jobs, more lower paid jobs. And technology is doing more and more of the heavy lifting. So as this plays forward, the combination of the demographic shifts, the technology, and the continued attempts to print money unsuccessfully in terms of creating inflation could all lead to a deflationary future. And in the deflationary future, gold is not a very good investment because it tends to slide. And if you talk to Harry Dent, for example, there's a show of two I've done with him quite recently. Harry was very clear that his view is of a deflationary future, and that means that gold is going to be lower than it is today. So those are the two scenarios. Both, I think, are valid at the moment, although I'm tending to veer towards the deflationary future, partly because of the technology and partly because of the demographic shifts. Now, Ronnie said, hope you're keeping safe. Yep, I am. Thank you. Been listening to you and to John Adams on the SARS virus. And I usually take John's side on things like the precious metals. But on this subject, I'm in your camp. I am a specialist pathologist and my sister is an infectious disease physician and microbiologist. I'm right up to date with most aspects of COVID-19 and completely agree with you and the Australian government at this stage. I'm concerned that the government is about to make a huge error and open up the economy. They obviously think we're different to Singapore or Russia. Expect a second surge. Well, yeah, Ronnie, thanks for that. And look, the fact is, it's tough to know. We don't know how long the virus is going to go on for. We don't know how serious it's going to be in terms of its penetration. We know that in the US, the testing there has shown that the virus is much more widely spread. In Australia, it doesn't seem to be, so the tests look to me to be quite low at the moment. But as you say, there is a massive risk of a second surge. And, you know, just think how horrible that would be, because we've basically put the economy on ice for the last few weeks. And if, when we start opening the taps, we then suddenly find that the takes off again and we have to actually go back into another period of lockdown, that's going to have a very significant economic impact. My own view, as I think I've expressed on a couple of other of my shows, is we should be aiming for zero. In other words, we should be keeping the tight controls in place sufficient to get to zero or close to zero. We still would need to keep the borders in place, and we would need to have very strong controls of any migration into the country. And we would have to have rigorous testing, and we would have to have spot crews that would deal with any outbreaks wherever it happened, and quickly. And of course, there is the interesting conversation between Australia and New Zealand, who's going down a similar path, and which St. Peter's over there is, I think, part of that, basically saying, well, if we actually got to zero here in Australia and in New Zealand, we could then create an economic zone where we have a zero tolerance for the virus. The risk that I see is if you go with the other camp, which is the economy needs it, and never mind, it's not really that serious, I think we're in for a horrible, horrible journey where effectively the infections rise again. And I don't know whether you've read much about the impacts on those who've gone through to the end stages, as it were, of the virus, and whether the people who've gone onto the breathing machines. But I was reading something the other day that suggests that about one third of people who go onto the breathing machines ever come off. In other words, two thirds die. And unfortunately, those who actually come off the machines will often have long-term damage. And therefore, this isn't something which you get over in just a few weeks. This could actually have long-term serious health impacts for them. So my own read is that this virus is way, way more serious than flu. It has to be treated with great respect. And therefore, I'm with you on this one. And I think we should be very cautious and not be persuaded by the business community or indeed some of the politicians who just want to get going again. I think that could be a major mistake. Now, Mark asked about oil futures, and of course, they closed at -$37.63 per barrel. And therefore, the question really is, how does this link to the value of the US dollar? Now, of course, you could argue, I think, and you've done in your post here, that essentially the US has become almost a petrodollar. Used to be backed by gold, went off the gold standard, and now we're on the petrodollar. So if oil goes down, what does that do to the value of the US dollar? And it's part of a broader question about what the nature of the reserve currency of the future is going to be, because I think you'd have to admit today it is the US dollar. And, you know, despite everything that's going on, the US dollar is still relatively strong, being supported by the Fed and the international swap lines to make sure that there are sufficient US dollars flowing around other areas too. But you wonder whether this is going to continue. And then, of course, the question then is, well, what's going to be the next replacement for the US dollar? Is it going to be the yuan? Probably not. Is it going to be some digital currency of some sort? There are some people who've been talking about that for quite some time. Or is it going to be something else? And I don't know. I can't read it yet as to where this is going to play out. But certainly, very low oil prices do have a very significant impact on US oil production, and it does have very significant impact on the value of the US dollar as well. So I think it does ultimately, as you say, bring into question what the value of the US dollar actually is. Now, Mark asks, If the Federal Reserve was a country, the amount of money printing it's done in 35 days, up to the 14th of April, so it's slightly longer than that now, would make it the eighth largest economy in 2019. He actually provided the graph to show it. How do you think this will affect the value of the US dollar? Yeah. So the first thing to say is it's huge. The amount that's been printed by the Fed, more than $2 trillion, and their balance sheet is more than 6.7, 6.8 trillion now. But you've got to understand why they're doing it. They're doing it essentially to provide liquidity to the whole financial system, not just in the US, but globally. And if you look carefully, what they've been doing is they've been buying assets from various different programs. I went through all these different programs in a post a couple of weeks ago. And that is putting more liquidity back into banks, into some of the other investment companies and entities, the hedge funds. It's putting money into pretty much every part of the financial system. What they're doing is propping it up. And so you've got to understand that this is not like a normal economy. This is a very abnormal thing that's going on, because the money is ultimately going to support the financial system. It's supporting the bad economic decisions that many companies made in terms of their share buyback some time ago. It's supporting the very high value of derivatives that are still there and present huge risks to the economy, as well as indirectly providing some liquidity to banks who can provide a little bit to households and to businesses. But if you look at it carefully, the proportion of the government stimulus package and the Fed package for real households and real businesses in the US is very low. The rest of it's supporting the financial system. So I don't think you can think of it just as a directly analogous to an economy. It's more myopic than that. It's more worrying than that. And as we discussed, it takes you into a discussion as to whether the future is going to be deflationary or inflationary. Now, Fiona said, my family parked our money for a principal residence in multiples of 250K, as per the APRA authorised depositing institutions, mainly building societies. Been listening to your forums. Well done. Yep, I've done the same. I've spread mine around, as I said, in multiple places. Can you please outline the scenario and implications if the RBA prints too much money as a stimulus measure over the next year, leading to a devalued Aussie dollar? How is this scenario likely to play out for people like ourselves wishing to re-enter the Sydney property market when the timing is right? For example, house prices may go down, but will the dollars in the banks be worth as much, relating to purchasing power? Okay, so this is quite a complex scenario we're talking about. So firstly, I think I'd say that the Reserve Bank and its liquidity programs, although they spoke big, haven't actually been huge so far. And so the real impact on the economy is probably relatively contained at the moment. They'll probably do more. And I did a post the other day making the point that they would have to increase their bond purchases to achieve their target. What they're trying to do is control the yield curve. They're trying to keep the three-month rate at around 0.25%, and they said they're going to keep that at that level for at least 3 years. And that tells you something about their view of inflation versus deflation in the economy and the fact that rates will stay low for a long time. Now, the question then is, will the Aussie dollar take a hit? Now, at the moment, it's not. It's up at 63. It was, you know, below 60 briefly a few weeks ago. And that's because the same programs are being run in most other countries too. So effectively, we're marking in lockstep with most other international currencies. And that means that we haven't seen a huge devaluation in the Aussie dollar. And I also have a view that because of the fact that we've still got the resource sector firing, and China's buying quite a lot of iron ore, and the fact that we still have a relatively benign economic scenario relative to some other countries, international investors are probably still going to invest in Australia in the next and foreseeable future. So whereas I thought a few months ago that the Aussie dollar was going down to head towards 50, I've changed my view a bit now, simply because of this international intervention in the marketplace, the significant increased liquidity in the financial system, triggered by the Fed as well as others, and the fact that the rate of exchange at the moment looks to me to be probably sitting around 60, 62, 63 ahead, So I wouldn't be too worried about devaluation at the moment, and therefore I think holding money in deposits makes a reasonable amount of sense at the moment. Now, Mark said, I really enjoy your content and foresight regarding QE, cash ban and Australian property. Keep up the great work. Yep, we intend to. I'd love to hear your thoughts on how COVID and the recession to follow will eventuate. I suspect the trajectory of current monetary policy and circumstance will lead us to a repeat of the 1970s, inflation versus devaluation of global currencies, and then a spike in interest rates to follow over the next decade. Like I said, Mark, it's one of the two scenarios. That is absolutely a potential scenario that effectively we have runaway inflation, interest rates go up, and that puts a huge dampening effect on the economy. But there is another one, as I mentioned earlier on, deflation. And at the moment, I would back deflation over inflation for simple of the reasons that I described earlier on. Firstly, the fact that we have a demographic shift going on and we have a technological shift going on. And as a result of that, I'm just not quite sure whether inflation will really take. Remember that central banks around the world have been trying for the last 4 to 5 years, or maybe longer, to get inflation between 2 and 3%. And they're just not making it. And the Bank of Japan has been at it longest, hopeless, absolutely hopeless at getting any inflation. So I am not sure that we're going to see an inflationary spiral this time around. Could be wrong. And the other point to make, just to re-emphasize again, a lot of this technology will be continuing to develop and basically releasing more people. So that basically there will be less people employed. That tells you something about future wages growth. And the other factor also is that a lot of the stimulus being put in the system is liquidity, which is supporting the financial system. And some of that may flow into home prices and those things, but a lot of it probably won't. And therefore, part of the question is where is the liquidity going and who's going to be the winners and losers? Generally, in this sort of situation, I think the winners will be the few percent who hold all the assets and all the value. And I'm not sure necessarily that we're going to see a lot of house price growth ahead. My own modelling suggests more house price falls. Gavin says, love your videos. Have you met anyone who has privy to the bank stress tests? You mentioned the banks have potentially a lot of defaulting mortgages. Do you think depositors' funds are at risk? I have funds with a firm that has big balance sheets and look okay on the outside, until they went under and took months to get my money out. Since I have money at CBA, I thought it was safe. Maybe a topic for your videos. Thanks, Gavin. Okay, so I'm not going to talk about specific banks, but I will make the point that I made a post the other day reporting what Moody had said about some of the regional banks and smaller banks. And they were saying that essentially some of those may be more at risk because they've got a specific alignment, for example, to the hospitality or the airline industry, where they might have a greater proportion of mortgages. The truth is that with the Reserve Bank's interventions over the last 6 weeks or so, and all of the methods that they've used, they have absolutely bolstered the banks dramatically, much more than I expected. So a few weeks ago, I would have said that the big organisations, because of their derivatives exposures and because of their mortgage exposures, would be probably some of the more risky lenders. I think I've changed my mind a little bit insofar that because of what the Reserve Bank has done, there's much more liquidity supporting the banking system than I expected. So all this talk about bailing in and bailing out looks to me that we're going to get a lot of support from government and from the Reserve Bank for the banking system, particularly the large players. So I'd be reasonably comfortable with the big players now and holding money there. I would keep it below the 250k limit, as I described earlier on. Useful to spread it across multiple organisations if you've got more than that. But I think the risks of a bail-in, deposit bail-in at the moment, are extremely low, and as I say, much lower than if you'd asked me 2 or 3 months ago. This is from Trish. Husband and I recently sold our family home and we're moving in with friends for a couple of months. After my home loan and other associated costs, we have $480k in my bank account. I was planning to place the money into my friend's mortgage offset account while I look for property. I think I might have discussed this briefly, but I thought it was just worth bringing this back because there are some interesting complications here. Because if you put money into somebody else's mortgage, into an offset account, the risk is that you may not get it back. So I'd be very cautious about this, even if you put an agreement in place, partly because the banks have a right of offset. So if you have a loan over here and you have other money in the same names, they can basically offset it one against the other. So I'd be a little bit cautious. And frankly, I think probably you might be safer just holding it into deposit accounts. And, you know, below the 250k limit, there are some reasonable deposit accounts, particularly term deposits, out there at the moment. But some of those, some slightly more sporty structures might be okay. Might need to get legal advice on it, but I'd just be a little bit cautious. Now, Katerina said, I want to thank you sincerely because of all the great work and valuable content you produce, including your work with John Adams. Because of both of you presenting such real economic data and commentary, not relying on inflated CoreLogic data. I sold my place in last year. I was mortgaged before the crisis, and I've invested in some bullion until the full situation unfolds. Good. Well, that's interesting. It's quite interesting how I've had a number of people react quite positively to what some of the things we've been saying and have taken decisions. And, you know, like I said, we don't give financial advice, but hopefully we can portray a little bit what's going on. But now she says, I'm trying to help my mum manage her finances and we're debating how much money she should leave in the bank for living expenses and what she should do with the savings, especially if we hit negative interest rates and or if there's a currency reset. My query to you is, do you have a view on when a currency reset might happen this year, early 2021, and how this could work in practice? E.g., for every five fiat Aussie dollars, you would get one new digital dollar. Banks take control of your account. Would you consider a vlog on the subject? I think your audience would find this valuable. Yep. So there is a lot of debate about, is there going to be some sort of restructuring or reset in the financial system? And there are many, many people on YouTube who's arguing for it, either digitally enabled or because of some sort of, you know, control mechanism that's there centrally. I'm a bit skeptical of some of those, I must tell you. I do think that whether the current economy here and around the world survives or not will be determined predominantly by what happens over the next 6 to 12 months. So question one, what's going to happen with the virus? You know, is the economies around the world going to bounce back or is it going to actually be a long, slow grind? I suspect a long, slow grind. The second is, how much liquidity support will there be? Well, we've already seen that liquidity support from central banks are huge. They will do whatever it takes to keep that liquidity support in place. And there is frankly no limit. They've clearly said that. So I think we should take into account the fact that there will be significant liquidity support for the existing financial system. The third is that most of the central banks and most of the G20 are very wedded to the current financial system that exists. And therefore, I think it's going to be quite unlikely that there's going to be a massive revolution anytime soon. However, having said that, there is certainly a risk of negative interest rates. And the IMF paper last year made the point that to reset and restart an economy, you'd need to have an interest rate cut of 4-5%. Now, if you had an interest rate of 4-5%, where interest rates are currently 1% or low, 0.25% here in Australia, that takes you into negative interest rate territory. Negative interest rates have all sorts of unintended consequences. We've seen that in Germany, where some depositors now have to pay to hold money in the bank. And that is probably more of a likely scenario than a complete reset of the whole financial system. So it's effectively a continuation of the trends that we've seen with low and lower interest rates. But of course, as you get into negative interest rates, a few things happen. And there was some research done in Europe about this. The first is banks lend less because they can't make a return on loans. Secondly, they are quite often unable to take interest rates on deposits into negative territory because people then just whip the cash out of the banking system and hold it in cash, which is one of the reasons why many people were suspect about the cash ban, me too. And then the third thing that happens is that the banks tend to take higher risk, more speculative ventures to essentially try and increase returns to shareholders. So put that all together, and my own view is this sort of theoretical view of a complete financial reset, I think is relatively unlikely at the moment. Could be wrong, but that's my own view. I think we will see some changes at the edge. I also think the interest rates will be very low for a very long period of time. The low is said at least 3 years at 0.25%. But I'm not sure that we will go deeply negative here in Australia. And I suspect that there is also quite a lot of concern now in other places because this negative rate strategy doesn't look to me to be very effective and frankly would require limitations on cash that in many countries have been completely unaccepted. And you finish up, Katrina. Thank you again. You really have made a real difference to me and my family, and we are in better shape financially than a lot of other people. You definitely contributed to this. Thank you so much. And it's really, really good to hear positive stories. And, you know, if there are other people watching that you've actually benefited from what we've done and how we've actually commented on what's been going on, do put comments in the question in the section below. Always interested to see those. And I do occasionally get the other view, and that is, you know, you thought properties were going to fall and they didn't and I missed out. Well, I'm sorry, that's you know, one of those things. Timing, of course, is the question. Wait a bit longer and property prices will probably fall further. Now, Jack asked, I'd be very interested to hear more about your thoughts on MMT. In the most recent discussions with Tab Brooker, you had some interesting statements at MMT, but I sense you had more to say but chose to hold back. Yes. Is your take on MMT that it is far less inflationary and therefore perhaps appropriate when the monetary is targeted at productive the economy, but that it is inflationary when it's targeted at finance and property? Yeah. So that's, in a nutshell, Jack, my view. So MMT is something which I've still got some concerns about, but in the current environment, the idea is that MMT people will say, don't think of the bank balance sheet or the government balance sheet, particularly the government balance sheet, as the same as a personal balance sheet. It's not the same. Governments have unlimited capacity to create finance if they need it. But the real interesting question is, what do they do with it, right? And the idea is, MMT says, if governments can create more funds and they use those funds to invest in productive things like, for example, universal income, which I actually am quite supportive of. So people actually have some basic right to an income, whatever they do. If it's flowing towards investment, which creates a bigger economy later and creates more value, then that's good. And if it flows into other real productive stuff, like, for example, a green revolution, all of those things have potential positively good outcomes for the broader economy. And therefore, MMT can be a catalyst for creating a bigger, a more just, and more flexible economy into the future. The risk is, if you start using MMT-type strategies, but effectively take those funds and use it to prop up the financial system or prop up the international financial system even worse, then that isn't being used for productive purposes. And that is essentially just keeping the fingers in the dike on the current financial system, and I've got a problem with that. So it really is a question not just of, yeah, sure, governments can always, you know, create as much as they want in terms of the momentum for investment. It's what they do with it. It's how it's managed and executed that really makes the difference. And I think there should be a change in the narrative from MMT good, MMT bad, to a conversation about how to effectively execute MMT, if that's the way you want to go, and where you should be putting those funds, and what the outcomes are that you should be measuring to ensure that you get the big bang for the buck. I still am a bit nervous because I still think, and maybe it's just my banking background, but, you know, to my mind, big debt is not as advantageous as small debt, because big debt takes longer to pay off and you ultimately have to pay it off. But there will be many who say, no. With interest rates so low, you can just roll it over and keep creating more value. And eventually you will create so much value that then you will have the capacity to effectively repay later. So you're putting it into the future. Problem there is, I worry about, you know, those from the next generation and generation after who potentially have to pick up the pieces. And that isn't necessarily always positive. Anyway, that's my thoughts on MMT, Jack. Hope that helped. And you end up, thanks for all the work you do. You are prolific. Well, yeah, we do generate most days. One day, I hope when all this financial madness ends, the record will show that you are one of the few calling it like it is. Well, I hope so. I mean, I'm just calling it the way I see it based on my research, my analysis, and based on the information that I have to hand. And, you know, I do change my views a little bit as things morph, as you see, but I do have some fundamentals that I also come back to, so we'll see. Don't change the intro and outro music, please. My 20-month son loves it. Good to know. It's really hilarious how some have really latched on to the new theme tunes and really love it. Others still say, yeah, I want the old one. Can't win all the time, but I actually quite like the ones that I've produced so far, and I'll continue to use them for certainly a little bit longer. And then just make a suggestion, and thank you very much for that suggestion. Another somebody to talk to. I am reaching out to a number of different people. I get a lot of suggestions from a lot of different people as to people who might come on the show and watch this space. We'll see what we can do. And if there are others out there watching, make suggestions. I can always reach out and see whether I can get people to come on to the DFA channel. We had George Gammon last week, which I think was a pretty successful show, and we'll probably get George on again down the track. Now, Bob says, if enacted, NASIC instructs the banks to remove funds, as to say, solvent from our bank deposits, and we're left with a couple of pennies to rub together, is it possible for them to double dip? For example, some people may be able to redeem funds from overseas under the mattress sell diamonds or such like and put money in their bank accounts for living expenses. Would the system and the legislation allow for those new funds to also be bailed in and thus be double dipping into a person's bank account? Right. So what you're really saying, Bob, is a deposit bail-in at a point in time, or is it a drip fee? The answer is there's no legislation about that at the moment, but generally the suggestion I think would be, and this is subject to any legal wrangle that may happen, it will be a point in time thing. So the way it runs, and you should look at the Open Banking Resolution in New Zealand, which is the most articulated position that I've seen with regard to this particular exercise, that essentially if a bank got into difficulty and it looked as though it could need a recapitalisation, things would be frozen temporarily. A share of deposits would be taken and converted into equity in the bank, and that would allow the bank then to effectively re-establish itself and start trading again. The rest of those deposits would be then handed back to the depositors. But that's a one-time thing. Now, what happens if the bank gets into trouble subsequently? Could they double dip again? I suppose in theory they could, but I suspect that this would more likely be a one-off exercise. And by the way, whilst it has been done in a couple of countries around the world, there's no doubt in my mind that this will be a major, major issue if it was ever done here in Australia and even in New Zealand, because people still believe that when you have a deposit at the bank, they're holding the money for you in sort of trust, but that's not true. Your money in the bank is an unsecured loan to the bank, and therefore you rank below a whole bunch of other people in the case of a crisis. So that's my perspective, but I could be wrong. As I say, no legal case, not being tested here, but more likely to be a point in time thing, I think. And Sarah asks, question I like covered on YouTube channel, please. Most economists are focusing on this, how this will directly affect their country, with not so much consideration to the effect of the work world, except in, say, a global recession, depression. What I'm curious about is this. The debt issue is universal, whether public or private debt. As you've covered before, most countries and governments will never be able to pay their debts. They can only cover the interest payments. Is there a chance that financial leaders, key countries, might unite to drive hyperinflation across the world to be able to wash out the debt again? Yeah, like I said, the one of two scenarios, right? So deflation, inflation. The inflation scenario, the hyperinflation scenario, is all about devaluing the amount of debt in the system. But if you think about the amount of debt that's out there at the moment, which is bigger than it's ever been, the amount of hyperinflation that you would need and the length of time that you would need it to run for to reduce the debt to something more normal would be 50, 60 years. So I'm not sure that this hyperinflation route actually is a viable strategy now. We've actually got too much debt. And if you talk to a lot of these central bankers and you ask them how much debt is too much debt, they'll say, we don't know. We're happy with how much debt we've got because of the interest rates so low. I asked Stephen Keane the same question some time ago, and Steve Keane said, probably a quarter of what we've got currently is, you know, just about manageable. So we've got a huge amount of debt in the system, and it's a combination of public and private debt in different locations. In Australia, up until now, it's been predominantly private sector debt. In other countries, like in the US, it's been more public sector debt. But debt is still a burden. And if, in fact, because interest rates were higher, the cost would be also bigger to service, that means that there is less and less available to pay for real goods and services that the governments need to deliver to their population. So I don't think it's necessarily going to work. That's my own view, but it could be wrong. And I still think a deflationary cycle rather than an inflationary cycle is more likely to be ahead. Okay, so there you go. I'm now caught up to date with all of the various things. Just to say that if you want more information about DFA, go to the DFA blog. You'll find a lot more information there. We put all of our posts up. And what I would say is that there's always more to talk about than time to talk about it on the DFA channels. But I do try and cover a bit more on the DFA blog. So I just recommend that. The links are in the comments below. So I hope that's been of some use. And thank you very much for all those who sent the questions in. Like I said, I tended to pick the thematics that allowed me to cover quite a few of the issues. And I hope this was useful today. We'll do some more of this again. There will be some more questions, I'm sure. Our next show is going to be in early May. There'll be details of that shortly. And I always appreciate questions at any time. So if you've got something you'd like me to discuss, if you'd like a question you'd like an answer to, feel free to send those in via the DFA blog, links below, or you can send it to me on Twitter, or indeed put the comments in the YouTube and I'll pick them up from there. So thank you for your time today. I hope that was useful, and we'll pick up again next time. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you next time.